Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are in your ears thanks to the quite magnificent oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it was a case of so near and yet so far on Saturday as another great performance went unrewarded and we left Villa with absolutely nothing. Despite taking the lead, lapses in concentration and injury time at the end of each half and a stupid red card ultimately did for us, but today we have the opportunity to get back to winning ways with Everton visiting the Amex. The Toffees have been on a bit of an indifferent run themselves of late and we'll be hoping that their win at home to West Ham last week will see them turn the corner. Let's hope not, eh? Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wes. We are very shortly to have a Raw version, who we'll introduce at the time, but we've got a bloke who knows a little bit about football shirts in the studio today.
It's our sponsor, yay! Best behaviour, AD.
Good afternoon.
And hello, Phil Shelley.
And for some reason, you're very making good. Me sweat quite a lot at the moment, because I quite frankly...
That's not very nice, is it?
Let me explain. Right now, all I want to do is take this blooming jumper off, but I will... because it's
the blooming jumper.
As Louis Shelley, radio, who's mate. Hiding in the corner here, will tell us, it's quite warm in here. But but welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, AD. Thanks very much.
It's been a while since you've been... In the studio, so tell us a little bit more at Old Football Shirts. What number are we at now?
Oh, what number are we at? Oldfootballshirts.com now has 103,770 shirts on it.
Do tell us about how this all started. Go on.
For those who can't remember
the last... You were an 8-year-old boy playing in the mud.
I was an 8-year-old boy playing in the mud. I lived overseas for most of my childhood and got all my football news from Shoot Magazine, or Shoot and Goal Magazine.
Match Weekly.
Rovers.
And it was delivered to me normally 2 weeks after it came out, so I was reading the football scores from 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, for no particular reason, I was a Leeds United fan. So I can say that with a straight bat. My mum and dad bought me a white football shirt when I started at school, and I said, "Well, surely football shirts are red or blue," because I had no idea. And my dad then had to go out the following day to find out what teams wore white.
What country were you in at the time?
At the time, we were living in Holland or Cyprus.
Well, they should have been, orange.
No, we were living in Cyprus in 1970. So my dad had to go away and find out, because he knows nothing about football. When he came back and he said, "Right, Tottenham, England, Leeds or Preston?" So I decided to be Leeds.
Okay.
And I joined the Leeds United fan club out the back of Shoot Magazine, ordered myself a Leeds United badge and got my mum to sew it on lovely.
Right. But that was the way back then, really, because I mean, football shirt culture has obviously changed massively since then, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But I mean, back then it was basically just a plain white shirt or whatever the colour your shirt was.
Well, it was, and I think everybody sort of went that way, and then a little bit later, Admiral, as we all know, came along in 73-74 and kind of changed it hugely. And again, going back to the Shoot Goal magazine, again living overseas, there were adverts in the back for these shirts for teams like California Surf and Kansas City Wizards
designs,
and stuff like that.
You see, I used to have that Sabutio team.
Well, my very first actual official replica shirt was a California Surf Admiral shirt.
Brilliant.
I'd love to know where it is now.
There was a thing on, basically, you talk about Shoot and Match Weekly and things like that. They used to have these things and they were used to send off for a Sabutio team. You collect your tokens and you could send it off, and I did that, and I said, I've got this team that they wore a blue shirt with two white vertical stripes going across them, and it was
for those not watching on Super Reverb Vision. AD said vertical but then demonstrated diagonal. Yeah,
that's what I meant, diagonal. I don't know which direction
we've
I'm going.
Colour blindness and word blindness, we're doing well here, and then we've got actual blindness for me.
What I was saying was basically this team was great, and I'd never ever heard of them, and I've subsequently in my adult years I found out that team's name is actually on the Ofcom banned list.
Well, California Surf.
No, not that one.
All right. But yeah, you're talking about sort of shirts, and they were probably quite hard to come by because merchandising and clubs didn't really pick up on this until sort of like the mid to late 70s, did they?
Well, that was it. As I said, I saw these ads for these Admiral shirts. I couldn't afford to order an England shirt because they were more expensive.
Are we talking about the one with the red and blue stripe down the sleeve?
Yeah, it would have been.
They were beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely, and worth a fortune now if you've got a real one. So for me, that was the one that I got. We then moved to Holland, and yeah, sure enough, I managed to get my parents to buy me an orange Adidas shirt of the Dutch persuasion, which I absolutely loved. And again, now, this is a daft thing, my first shirt, the California Surf shirt, if I had it now, I'd comfortably get £400 or £500 for it on eBay.
Quite.
If I had the Holland shirt that I got in 78, probably a similar amount of money.
Sure.
And no idea where they are. I wore them to death.
Because for my 9th birthday, so it was just one of those things I remember, for my 9th birthday, September 1978, I got given the entire Albion kit. And I think I've seen a picture of you wearing it. It was the blue and white stripe one with the Buchter logos down the sleeves, knitted. It wasn't sort of cotton or that nipple-burning stuff or anything like that. It was knitted. Blue shorts with white piping down the sides, white socks, two hoops at the top, and a pair of Gola boots.
Wow.
And I think the whole lot came to £28. That was a fortune for my mum and dad in those days. But one thing you couldn't do was buy it from the Albion. I had to get ours from David Rose Sports up near the Seven Dials. And there was various places
around
town.
Well, that's role reversal there, though, isn't
we
it?
Had
because
a.
it's completely
Baker,
different now.
You had, well, absolutely. You had A.A. Baker in London Road, just around the corner from where we are now. You had Wisden Sport, I think, in Duke Street. And I think there was another one in Hayward Heath, I think there was.
There was one in Shoreham as well.
Sure.
And in Burgess Hill, Herb Sports,
yeah,
David White Sports.
Dotted around, but one thing you couldn't do is get them at the Albion. There was no club show. Well, there was a few bits and pieces, and I think there was eventually a porter cabin put in at the Goldstone, but they really dragged their feet when it came to merchandise.
Well, if you read in today's match programme in the part they wore the shirt, this week's one, because I've provided all the shirts for that piece in the programme, and for those lucky enough to have bought the Spurs programme, you would have seen a whole article about me in there. But this week's one is one of the Adidas shirts. I won't spoil your surprise, but I actually found an advert from a programme from Ian Hines' wonderful Seagulls programmes website.
That is a website worth
now,
looking at.
I
yeah.
found an advert for replica kit in one of the programmes. Now, interesting enough, the adverts for replica kit in that season were only in two or three of the programmes all season.
Really?
And there were no adult sizes available.
Kids, aren't they?
Large youth size, and the one I have in my collection is a replica.
To be fair, the kids of those days are the adults of now, and that's where it all started from, isn't it? Acorns, isn't it?
But it's worth noting now, of course, that that the shirts are pretty much only available directly from the club. I don't know if they can still get them in sports scene in London, but they have just opened a new shop in Churchill Square, finally got another a town centre presence again. And in that shop there is a game called Taxi.
Good gear crunch.
Seamless.
Brilliantly done.
And basically...
Think you'd wrote that down?
Yeah, I know, it's great. But it's a really good game. Myself and Adam had a go at this last week.
We did.
And we'll be speaking to Gordon Drysdale very, very shortly, who devised... he didn't devise the game, but he's part of the thing.
It's actually a better game than you'd give it credit for. We just very briefly, myself, AD and Andy, we were at Worthing game last week. We stopped by for a swift half at the Brookstead Ale House near Worthing Station afterwards. AD had the game with him. He was like an excited eight-year-old pup.
On Christmas Day.
We've got to play the game. We took over an entire table. We actually had a little bit of an audience watching us because we were nerdy anoraks. I think Andy had an unfair advantage because he's a relatively new Albion fan. But we sat and played the game and we really enjoyed it. It was a genuinely good game, so we'll be talking about that more later. And we got, as Andy says, we've got two copies of that to give away.
We have, and we'll be speaking to Gordon about all of that shortly. And it was very shortly, but we're almost then. But that's live radio for you. But it's great. And basically, there's
one wrote that as well.
Yeah, one of the key things with the game as well. Apparently, we're going to be talking to Gordon about this later. But it helps with things like Alzheimer's, where someone who might not realise what they've had for breakfast, but they could tell you what happened 50 years ago and who the goal scorers was, the attendance, and everything else, which is quite particularly prudent, particularly with the moment with the news this week about Frank Worthington.
Well, absolutely. There's also sorts of things. I mean, let's face it, none of us are getting any younger. I mean, we can all probably remember so many aspects of our first ever game, but can you remember what happened in the most recent game? Which is probably what we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, let's talk about Villa then. And
anyone to think I wrote that?
Yeah. there was one change to the team with Davey Proper coming in for Stephen Alzati, and there was a second start for Aaron Connolly in this one. Now, Phil, how impressed have you been with the two youngsters so far?
I think Connolly, it goes without saying, and I think you were talking about it last week, he's the man of the moment, really, or the boy of the moment. excuse me. The I think it's finally getting this opportunity to see players coming through and actually making an impact on the team, which we haven't seen at all. Alzati, I mean, he just looks wise beyond his years, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He seems to have an incredible amount of use all the cliches, composure on the ball. I think there's some excitement some excitement ahead for us. Let's just hope that they are actually the real deal. Long term, I'm renowned for my occasional pessimistic look about the way we've brought players on over the years. But in all honesty, these two, and I think
I remember when we got promoted, Phil. I think you said that was quite good.
Yeah.
But of course, one person who was at the game on Saturday was a man called Sean Pankhurst. He's finally joined us.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, a Raw Virgin. We're always like one of those. We'll talk to you about your Albion supporting history first. But how did you find Villa on Saturday?
It was a good watch. I thought, you know, for the first time we actually we looked like we knew what the game plan was. We looked like we were holding on to the ball well. We were, you know, playing forward, which was good. And I thought we were the better side throughout most of the game.
Well, this is the thing as well, Phil. We've been playing this absolutely wonderful brand of football this year, but the results haven't actually been there. And you can play the best football in the world, but if you're not putting the ball in the back of the net, you're going to end up in exactly the same position where we were last year.
Well, hopefully we've got somebody who can put the ball in the back of the net now with a bit more fitness and youth on his side. The thing with Alzati, with Connolly, what they're also playing with is some really good players supporting them in the likes of Dale Stevens, Lewis Dunk,
everyone's playing that 10, 15 yards further forward, aren't they? And there's movement.
But you've also got an opportunity for these youngsters who are full of enthusiasm, actually with people behind them who can support them for it. And perhaps in the past we had the enthusiasm, not the fitness, or perhaps the people at the back weren't offering that level of quality that the people moving forward needed, but they didn't have the people to play the ball to. Now they have.
Can you imagine that with the liveliness of Connolly and Mopai? I know obviously he wasn't here, nor was Trossard, but can you imagine actually playing them playing in that kind of, and I don't want to criticise the fellow too much, in that kind of stultifying way that we played at the end of last season? Can you imagine that? It would have been square pegs and round holes, wouldn't it?
But you have to remember when you're looking at a player, a team on the pitch, and I remember years ago watching Ron Atkinson being interviewed, he said, when the players step over that line, I really don't have any influence over what they do anymore. They do their own thing. And I think even under the previous regime, you didn't have players that were putting themselves about. You didn't have players who were taking the initiative. Mm. And I think the likes of Alzati, Moy, even, Connolly, and of course Mopai as well, I think they actually will take it responsibility themselves to go and do this stuff, whereas before I think the players were just thinking, oh no, Chris said don't do that.
I think it's important to look at the movement off the ball as well. I mean, when I was at the Villa game last week, you know, the difference that I saw was, you know, I watched Connolly's movement, I watched Mopai, and they looked like they were wanting the ball and moving, you know, to find space, yeah, which I think is something that I haven't seen before.
Well, this is one of the things that was one of the criticisms that was levelled at Chris Hughton last year, and the stories we've heard coming out and subsequently confirmed out of the club that there wasn't a plan going forwards. It was very much about a defensive shape, but let the attacking players just do whatever it is they can do. But now there seems to be a plan. There seems to be a better way of playing through the lines, a better way of attacking, and the players seem to know exactly what their jobs are.
But what you had was, you know, the ball would just be lumped up to Glenn Murray. The entire sort of attacking ethos was lump the ball up to Glenn Murray and hope that he's actually going to be able to keep it. And the midfield, who've got this defensive mindset, been told to have this defensive mindset, take quite a while to get up and join them. You might have had Pascal Gross within 20 yards of Glenn Murray, but now the way that the ball is played, and there was far too much long ball stuff last year just to get the ball out, it's actually just making me think, all those that watch England New Zealand earlier, the way that, you know, England absolutely battered New Zealand, and all New Zealand could do was just clear their lines and hope that then we could move up. That's kind of how I feels with watching the Albion last year. Just lump it up to Glenn Murray, hope he can keep it, and then, you know, the rest of the team would eventually turn up. It doesn't work that way this time.
Now, one of the criticisms, Sean, that has been levelled was all of the goals have basically all come from the forward players, and we need goals from all over the pitch. And we did get one in this game. We took the lead, and it was Adam Webster scoring his first Albion goal.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, literally, ball comes from the far side, and he's at the back post, and you know, it was. We all turned to each other in the stand and sort of said, you know, what a finish!
It was a great set piece as well. Now I think is that our first set piece goal of the season? Mm-hmm. I think it is, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, yes.
Maybe.
Answers on the postcard.
Did you write that?
But it was the ball from Pascal Gross. It was angled towards the far post, and basically all he had to do was get something on it. I mean, even then, and I've got to give some credit to Connolly and Morpie here, they tried to steal the goal.
But again,
they were sliding in on the line, just trying to get a touch on it. They wanted to steal the goal.
But the mere fact that they were there, you know, sort of, you know, you got two, you know, 25-inch sniffers here who are looking out to do that, then brilliant. You know, where would our lot have been before? Mm. Just standing around like, I'm being overly critical, but it is probably the most stultifying football we watched earlier this season. And the gear crunch, the 180, the Voltfass, is incredible. Yes, and I've said this before, and I do believe that's the case, because there's been such a major way of turning around the football from how we were playing to how we are playing, these things take time to bed in. We're talking about the same players. It's not as though there's been a complete overhaul of the squad. It's the same players. They've got to relearn things. And these things take time. And I say about a third of the season, I believe that from here on in, those results will come. For those that are going to listen to this after the Everton game, and we're recording this, we're doing this before the Everton game, if Everton don't turn up, I fancy us giving someone very soon a good hiding. Mm. More so than Spurs, because let's face it, with the Spurs 3-0, that scoreline flattered Spurs.
Now, sure, we've seen some really wonderful football played by us this year, but there was a chance we had to make it 2-0, and I just want to just quickly sit here and purr a little bit about the move that almost saw Aaron Connolly double the lead, and the ball with the slide rule pass from Neil Morpie that put it on the plate for the young Irishman.
Purr away.
It was just wonderful, wasn't it?
It was amazing, yeah. I think maybe, you know, a little bit older, a little bit more experienced, he might have taken the ball around the keeper, had a bit more time to think about it. But, you know, I mean, you're splitting hairs there. You know, yeah. the chance that he had.
I mean,
was,
if he fainted to shoot, then maybe put the keeper on his arse, then it might be. But yeah, if it was. But then our undoing happened. We've got to talk about Aaron Moy and the red card. Now, the first booking. Now, I'm not arguing that it wasn't a booking to the letter of the law. It most definitely was. But we just want to see a little bit of consistency with this, really.
Though, how many times have we moaned about the fact that defenders always block a free kick being taken? We think, oh, come on, that's a yellow card. Come on, that's a yellow card. And it happens. And we got two in the same game. Yeah, it's correct. And I take your point about the consistency. Absolutely. Though it was a correct yellow card, but you're quite right. It should happen every single time. There is every obligation for a defender to get away. And I think it's unprofessional for one player to belt the ball at another in order just to get a yellow card. But it's also extremely unprofessional for someone to block it, because their obligation is to be 10 yards away.
Well, Moy's explanation was that he thought the free kick was being taken from the wrong place. But, I mean, there's no real excuse.
That's not his choice.
But it was just basically he was just stopping it from being taken quickly. Absolutely. I mean, we see it all the time. I mean, when Glenn was a master, do you remember him? The second one, again, it was a tackle he didn't actually need to make. And it was very, very quickly after the first one. It's almost like he'd forgotten that he'd been booked. But, I mean, the villain number 10 did go down to ground a little bit.
Who are we talking about?
I don't know. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, we all turned to each other in the stands. And
Tony.
As soon as he made the tackle, we thought, you know, we feared the worst. It was not good.
But then...
it raises the extra point. And let's face it, everyone's also then talking about Florin Andoni's red card. And in the Premier League, you have to... I mean, look what happened with Southampton last night. Went down to 10... I don't think it's down to the fact they went down to 10 men that made them lose 9-0. It's just the fact they're rubbish. But therein lies the point. When we played Southampton, they were rubbish. But actually, it seriously handicapped us by having our lead striker being sent off. And in both cases, both the Moy one and the Andoni one, they were utterly, in different ways, they were utterly brainless. And they've got to get their heads around that. And especially when we've had earlier in the season, he's not doing it now, Alzati falling over a little bit too easy. No, diving. That's got to stop. We are going to be punished for that.
Ultimately, do you think the red card cost us the game?
No. Honestly, no. I thought, you know, what I was, you know, another thing that I was really impressed with was that, you know, we stood our ground. We didn't fall back either. We didn't pack out the box. We didn't sit behind the ball. We still tried to play football
and still tried to win the game.
Yeah, and we still tried to win the game, but. You know, I think we were unlucky with that, you know, that goal at the end. I think, again, you know, we all looked at each other and sort of thought, well, it's unfortunate, but we couldn't have done any more.
Now, we've seen VAR intervene against us this year. Now, we've had one go in our favour. Now, Phil, I know you love the bit of VAR action, don't you?
No.
I'm going to stick my neck out and say goal.
It was harsh. Almost every single VAR decision I've seen has been so pernickety it's ridiculous, including if you take the Spurs tackle on the Watford player on last weekend. I mean, how can anyone on any planet with an eye not see that was a penalty? But of course it was Spurs, so you don't really want to give them a penalty against them, do you? And I'm afraid that's why it's so nonsense. I have a little minor rant here. They did not need VAR. They needed to say, in the same way as it works in that other game, rugby, that was on earlier, you do not surround the ref. The ref's decision is absolutely final. I know they have their own equivalent of VAR, but they don't at every level. It's only at the Premier level there, and it's not in every country either. VAR is not required. If you say crystal clear to every team and every player, if you dive, if you round the referee, you will be sent off. If you dive, you will be banned for 12 months. Not 2 weeks, 3 games, 4 games. If you do that, you would solve all of the problems and you wouldn't need VAR. If you say the linesman will do their very best to call offsides correctly, but we're all used. How long have we been watching football? How many times have we seen goals given for offside goals given when there was an offside or goals
but
not given when
it wasn't?
And I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
But the problem that they seem to bring VAR in is they're looking at, you know, millimetres of offside
fingernails.
Decisions and stuff. But listen, I haven't got any problem with any of the goals that we've had disallowed for it. And I thought that, you know, Villa were unfortunate. The thing is that VAR isn't needed. What is needed is a slightly more robust attitude towards the prima donnas. And it's only, let's face it, we go and watch Worthing play every other week, right?
Yep.
They don't have any VAR there,
no.
And their linesmen are amateurs.
Yeah.
We enjoyed a game perfectly well, and everyone gets over it if there's a bad decision.
Absolutely, except Andy Bass.
But,
but also, if we're going to talk about VAR, let's talk about the point that you raised earlier, Adi. Now, it's something on the train on the way in. That's fine, and it's, I think it kind of follows on from Paul Barber's point about the fact that people in the stadium for VAR are kept in the dark as to what the decisions are. Make your point about what you were saying on the train earlier about how rugby. Not rugby can be done to the rules of football.
It's just a transparency. Basically, I mean, like I said, the Nigel Owens was there. He was having a conversation with the video officials on the pitch. Everyone in the stadium could hear the conversation. Obviously, they couldn't see the visuals. Nigel Owens couldn't see the visuals, but they're hearing the conversation about the discussion about what's happened, and that's all we want to know. Basically. Why can't the refs be mic'd up like they are in other sports? They're even doing it in cricket now as well.
Would you be happy with that if it meant that say for instance an offside decision or something like that wasn't put up on a screen? You'd be happy just to hear the conversation?
To hear the discussion, to find out basically, so we know what's happening, we know what the discussion is about, we know. I mean, for instance, that first disallowed try today, it was like, was it offside? Did he ever? I'm saying try, or what are you saying? And they're basically looking at it and going, right, okay, he was doing this, that, and the other. So basically, go on.
Yeah, well, I watch, you know, I go to rugby games as well. And you know, you're able to have a headset in the stadium as a fan, so you can listen to, you know, not only the commentary but obviously again what the referee's saying. When I went to the Villa game last week, it was the first time that I had actually seen, you know, they had put up an advert pre-game to talk about VAR, to explain to the fans exactly what was going to be given, what wasn't going to be given, and what they're going to be looking for from VAR. And quite honestly, I didn't take it all in myself.
No.
I don't think, you know, the problem that we have with football is generally speaking that, yeah, we're woolly about what we want to do with it.
Okay, well, let's just move on. Basically, Villa did equalise and the defending was shocking.
Go on.
You were there.
I wouldn't say the
Jack, there were five Albion players in the box,
and you still, always blame the goalkeeper.
And
saying
the
Aston
Villa number 10 who's got a similar name to the guy who captained us in the 83 Cup final.
Yeah, I'm always sort of a little bit more positive when it comes to the team, and I get really.
You mean realistic?
I just get really. I see a lot of people, you know, chastising the team when I go on the fan sites and stuff like that. I just think, you know, yes, it was a lapse in concentration, but at the end of the day, you know, things like that can happen.
Okay. Well, I mean, we bossed the game, bossed the possession, didn't take our chances. That's pretty much it. And then there was the late sucker punch again at the end. And again, it was poor defending from me. It's bad game management.
That's not about game management. That is a phrase that has no meaning.
Well, Pascal Gross kicked it into touch and gives him the ball back with 30 seconds to go. And
it still needs defending. But you know, that's not game management. That's a ridiculous thing that commentators come up with. It has sort of very little meaning. So you've got, they got the ball in the net. As Sean said, that's what happens. They're human. You know, they did it. So I mean, you could argue that absolutely every single goal that's scored is bad defending because. You know, if you're going to have defenders, and there's usually more defenders than there are attackers, you can always say that every single, unless you score an absolute worldie from 40 yards. Yeah. Steve Sidwell against Bristol City, was that bad defending?
It was terrible defending.
Okay, so, but Sean, the performances are there, but not necessarily the points. You think it's just a matter of time?
I feel really positive about it. You know, for the first time in a long time.
Okay, let's leave that one there and we'll move on to today's game. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are brought to you in association with the fabulous Phil Shelley's oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil, we've got a shirt of the week, haven't we?
We do have a shirt of the week, Adi, and you're wearing it. I slipped it on you while you weren't looking.
I know, so
it's quite disgusting.
So I'm gonna strip off, woof.
Okay, give me I'll read out the shirt of the week while you do the running around bit. Have you got your pieces of paper ready? Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, while Adi disrobes himself, I'm sorry for those that don't have super reverb vision. The webcam doesn't exist. Sean, do you want to have a go at describing that?
I thought you were going to try and ask me to guess which club this is. It has some sort of X-ray body kind of illustration on the front. There's a heart in full colour, whereas the rest of it is black and blue. Kaja Rural at the bottom there. That's sort of...
I think that means rural cash.
Yeah, must be Colombian then. Looks like some Spanish text on the back there.
Sure. Okay, well, this is what, as Adi would say, this is what Phil Shelley of Old Football Shirts has written. Please. It's the 2018-19 third shirt of Zamora Club de Football from the city of Zamora in Castile and León region of western Spain. The shirt features a depiction of the human circulatory system with the Zamora Club badge and its beating heart. The veins and arteries even extend down to the shorts. Oh, my God. So long. Please tell me that the shorts do not have the similar X-ray that go...
There are no testes on the shorts.
Thank you. Okay. On the back is the motto, which translates something like red fluid that transports life through our bodies and feeds our emotions and feelings. I think that's called blood, isn't it?
The translation reads red fluid.
The team currently play in the Castilla and León region of the Tercera Division, the fourth tier of Spanish football. Built in 2002, their home ground is the 8,000 capacity Estadio Ruta de la Plata. Who can translate that? No, me neither. Don't care. There isn't really much of interest about the side or their past players. The city sounds pleasant enough. They have a special custard and almond dish called Las Natillas Almendradas. So thanks very much for that, Phil. And where else can we see shirts as hideous as that online?
Well, I've got a website. It's called oldfootballshirts.com. It's a gallery of football shirts from all over the world. Just over 103,000 on there.
I'm looking forward to the real pub team that actually has a football shirt that's got a sort of an imprint of sick down the front.
But I feel like Nigel Tufnell because it's like it's an exact replica of my insides.
Indeed.
No, Adi, that one has a heart on it.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, as we mentioned earlier, we've got some copies of the brand new board game Taxi to give away this week, and we're now joined by Gordon Drysdale. Gordon, are you there?
Hi, Eddie. Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Welcome to the Albion Raw, Gordon. Now, as I mentioned, some of you may have noticed that there's a brand new Albion Raw game called Taxi on the market. So it's just in time for Christmas as well, isn't it, Gordon?
Perfect.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the origins of the game?
Sure, yeah, happy to. So the game started a few years ago. My business partner, a chap called Derek, he was a taxi driver, and he was sitting in the rank one day, maybe 12th in the rank, waiting on the next passenger. And he started to think, wouldn't it be great to develop a board game? And that was kind of how it started. So Derek developed the game, and I got involved about 4 years ago. And we started off, the game was very much a trivia game based on the life of a taxi driver. We had strap lines like, the better your knowledge, the better your tips. A cabbie's got an opinion on every subject, so we have something called sound off in the game as well. And there's an element of luck, something called give or take. If a cabbie turns left, he gets a £200 fare to the airport. If he turns right, somebody bangs him over the head and takes his day's taking. Yeah. So it's a game with sort of three features in it. We started by city, so we did Edinburgh, Glasgow, London and New York editions. And then we're sports fans, and we're football fans particularly. So, and we live in Scotland, as you may tell from the accent. So
I'd never guessed.
So we approached the biggest team in Scotland at the time, and currently is Glasgow Celtic. So we approached them, not really thinking they would be interested. And much to our surprise, they said, yeah, they loved it. So we produced a Celtic edition, and then that opened the doors in Scotland. Once we had Celtic on board, we got Hearts and Hibs, which are the local teams for Derek and I, and then Aberdeen. We can get Rangers because Rangers are in a bit of a commercial dispute with Mike Ashley, so that's kind of dragging.
Yeah, best leave that one there, I think. But I mean, there's lots of different versions, as you said. So how did the Brighton one come about?
Well, my son studies at Glasgow University. We had aspirations to do our English Premier League version this year. My son studies at Glasgow Uni. He shares a flat with four other guys. There's five of them there. One of the chaps comes from Watford, and his dad works for Tony Bloom.
Oh.
He fashioned an introduction to the correct people in Brighton for me, and then we all had to go and speak to them, sell the concept. But Brighton really liked it, and hey presto, Brighton became the first English Premiership club.
Yeah, that, I mean,
we were doing the edition for.
And so basically, there's how many Brighton questions are there in the game?
There's 500 Brighton questions in the game. Based on previous managers, old players, successes, important games in the club's history and the like. And you can tell we're football fans, but we didn't know too much about Brighton, so we tapped into a couple of really, really helpful people.
Yeah, one of them was Tim Carter, wasn't it? He is the encyclopedia of all things Albion, let's face it.
Yeah, so we had great help from them. We also had great help from We Are Brighton and the Seagulls programs, Jappy and Hines. So yeah, really, really helpful guys. And I've got to say, the club themselves, the club historian, fantastic chap. Really, we've dealt with lots of football clubs, and we're moving into rugby now, but we dealt with lots of football clubs, and the club were a joy to deal with. They really were.
Yeah, myself and Alan had a go of this at the weekend, and it's wonderful. And the sound of cards as well in there. They're those ones are probably a lot more fun and probably cause more arguments than anything else. But it was great. Now, basically, there's been studies on board games, etc., which that they're really, really helpful with things like Alzheimer's. So tell us about the Sporting Memories Group.
Sure. Okay. So about January of this year, we signed a deal to do a Scottish football edition with the Scottish Football Association. And we agreed all the terms. And then just at the end of the deal, as we were concluding it, he says, and could we have 35 copies of the game once it's manufactured? We want to give it to the Sporting Memories groups. And I wasn't too aware of it, so I explored a bit further. And there are 35 groups, mostly associated with football clubs in Scotland, where people living with Alzheimer's come together, sometimes on a weekly, sometimes on a fortnightly basis, at the clubs. And these are guys who maybe struggle to remember what they ate for their breakfast, but you engage with them in football, and the transformation in these guys is incredible, absolutely incredible. They come alive, you know. So something that they may not remember, as I say, what they had for breakfast, but something that happened 30, 40, 50 years ago with their favourite team, my goodness, it really engages with them. So the game is used as a kind of catalyst for starting the conversation, and quite often it moves off into tangents, talking about old dance halls or old cinemas or old TV programs or old sweeties that they used to get, that sort of stuff. But it really, it's used as a mechanism to just start the conversation, if you like, in these sort of places.
Yeah, I mean, and that is it's so important, because I mean, Alzheimer's is such a horrible condition, and you know, we know people have seen people suffer with it, and it's not just the person that suffers, it's their families, because it's you're seeing someone just basically disintegrate before your eyes. So it's basically to see their eyes light up and to see them engage with something again, it's something quite wonderful.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it the first time I saw it. The transformation in one chap my mum used to suffer from dementia, and in the care home when I used to go and see her, there was one chap whose head was always bowed and never really interacted with anyone. And he picked up on something I said about football one day, and God, this guy became my best friend every time I was there, just talking about football. So yeah, it really works. And the sporting memories thing's fascinating, because not just do they have football memories now, we're doing a launch. We're about to launch a Scottish Rugby Union edition at Murrayfield next week, and the rugby memories chaps are coming along. So there's rugby, there's cricket, there's tennis, and so every major sport seems to have a sporting memories group. Okay. It really seems to be taking off.
Gordon, so where in Brighton can you get this game?
In Brighton just now, WH Smith's in Churchill Square, obviously the Brighton Football Club store. I think they've just launched a new store in Churchill Square as well.
That's right, yeah.
Some of the independent sports shops, obviously online in Amazon, eBay, and our own website, taxiboardgame.co.uk.
Okay, and we've got two copies of this to give away on the show today. And over to our sponsor, Phil Shelley from allfootballshirts.com, who has a question from the game.
Guess who I had in my cab? This Brighton goalie was at the club for 12 years, from 1981 to 1993, and appeared alongside Vinnie Jones in the film Mean Machine. Answers on a postcard.
So who is it? Not answers on a postcard. Please send your answer to... email it to thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk. Phil, could you read that, your guess who I had in the back of my cab again?
Guess who I had in the back of my cab? This Brighton goalie was at the club for 12 years, from 1981 to 1993, and appeared alongside Vinnie Jones in the film Mean Machine.
So if you think you know the answer to that, send an email to thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk, and we'll be picking two winners from all of the correct answers.
Okay, so many thanks for that, Gordon, and good luck with the game.
Cheers, Gordon.
Right, good to speak to you. Thanks again, Eddie. Bye.
That was Gordon Drysdale from the Taxi Game. It's really good fun, isn't it?
It is, actually, yeah. I mean, I did like the sound off bit. Basically, what we're talking about here is you've got question cards, and they have easy and hard ones, depending on the square that you land on. But there's also a sound off thing, and this is where you have to, you know, like taxi drivers, never backwards in coming, a bit like Albion Raw presenters, you know, never backwards in coming forwards with an opinion. And you just get given a subject matter. Usually totally unrelated to football, and in 30 seconds you just have to sort of name the buzzwords that are on the card.
Yeah, it comes with a little sign, and
you get sort of more. So basically what you're doing is looking to accumulate money. Accumulate money for everything you say. Yeah. It's all these little bits and pieces. It's good fun. Preferably after a couple of glasses of wine. It's a real hoot. I mean, when you see these things, oh, it's a board game. No, this is wonderful. It's really good fun.
Okay, just quickly before we move on, we've got a couple of things on the notice board. Firstly, today at the Everton game, obviously, if you're listening to this on the pod afterwards, this is absolutely no use to you whatsoever.
Well,
but if you are listening
it is,
live, it's the Albion community takeover at the Amex today. There's lots of people with buckets around, and all they're asking is for people just to drop a quid in the bucket, and you know, if 30,000 people drop a quid in the bucket, that's 30,000 quid for Albion in the community, and that money goes a long way to help an awful lot of people out.
But if you are actually listening on the podcast, then do it anyway. Yeah. You can still, you're not going to send a £1 cheque in the post, you might as well send a 20 quid cheque in the post.
Exactly.
And if 30,000 people did that.
Okay, and Al, just...
Yes, I've got to say, it's with sad news that we've got the notice that this morning that Albion fan Daniel Churchill sadly passed away this morning, or last night. It might not necessarily be a name that people are recognising, but if they if they Googled Daniel Churchill and realised the name that we're talking about here, it's a fellow that you see him everywhere. You saw him everywhere. Home game, away game, if there was a forum, if there was something to be had. Our sincerest condolences to his family and friends, and he's a part of the Albion family that's sadly lost now.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, but Sean... Now, we described
welcome
you as
to the show. We haven't we haven't had his Albion support in history.
I know.
Yet.
you are a royal virgin, so we have to ask you about your Albion supporting history that wasn't on a train when we started going on air.
Yes, I do apologise for my tardiness today. In terms of how I came to support Albion. It's a long story, but to cut it short. My dad used to play for the Albion for a little while. He was a Chelsea youth trainee and then got sold to Brighton back in the 70s, yeah. So that's how I ended up following Brighton. Although I do say to a lot of people that, you know, I come from a part of the country which is a bit of an anomaly. You know, most people, they grow up, their club chooses them. But I grew up in a town called Rye, which is east of Sussex.
Yeah.
So the nearest football club is 40, 50 miles away, whether that's Gillingham up in Kent or Brighton or up in London. So a lot of the kids at school were all supporting Arsenal and Spurs and people like that. And
Leeds.
Yeah, there's me.
So, yeah, I mean, so you had an interesting job. We have to ask you about this. Now... You ended up working... You're not there anymore, I believe, but you worked for Nike for quite some time.
I did, yeah.
And you were a kit designer.
I was.
Now, I've got a section here. It says kit nerds. Now, how many of
have
those...
Have you met Phil?
How many of those have we got in the studio today, Philip?
I'm going to raise my own hand as well.
So, now, I mean, obviously, there's that leads to a whole load of questions about templates and how it all goes. But how did you get involved with that?
Purely by chance, if I'm absolutely honest. But when I was growing up, and I was supporting the Albion and sort of playing football with my friends or whatever, and they all had their Arsenal, Spurs, and what have you kits on. It was more about the kit than actually playing football or what have you. So I used to get in a lot of trouble with my dad, who ran the local football team and was trying to drum orders into us and tactics and stuff like that. And I'd be too busy staring across the pitch at the other team and what they were wearing and how they were wearing it, to be quite honest.
So, but I mean, we were joking on the phone earlier this week that basically your entire Crayola collection ended up coming up with various garish designs. But you got to do that for real.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the 90s, so that was about the time that sublimation, as they call it, which is the print on the top you're wearing, just went bonkers. You'll remember some of those kits from those times.
Hideous.
Some of us look back on that.
How dare you?
A lot of nostalgia, quite honestly. And it's starting to come back now. Yeah. Without going into too much detail and boring everybody who's not interested in football shirts.
Who is not interested in football shirts?
But yeah, I that's the sort
I
of
thing.
I think
you're on a football show. I think you're on a safe ground here.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's the sort of thing that inspired me and essentially made me want to go to college and university and all the other sort of all the other stuff that I've done throughout my career to get to Nike and end up in that position.
Now you ended up in Holland.
I did.
And basically you were sat there at your desk one day and all of a sudden this memo appeared on your desk.
It did. Nike's European headquarters are in Holland, and essentially that's the reason why they have that is mainly for the football, because they can get to clubs throughout Europe quite a lot easier than they would in Portland in their WHQ. And I'd kept saying to Nike, you've got to look at this team in England because they're my team. But they're going to be doing big things. They are going. They are on the rise, and they are. You have to get hold of them. And then one day, you know, that kind of fell on deaf ears for a long time. And then one day, just like any other, I'm sitting there with my crayons, and a note appears. Or I get a phone call. Actually, it wasn't a note. You know, from the manager that manages the kits, that sort of said, "I've got a surprise for you. Come downstairs." I went downstairs to his office, and yeah, there was a few of them in there, ready to congratulate me on the fact that they just signed Brighton Hove Albion.
So what involvement did you have in designing Albion's kits?
Well, funnily enough, it wasn't one, you know, top of people's list in terms of you know, designers wanting to design it. You know, most people are more focused on, you know, those small teams you might not have heard of, like Barcelona and Juventus and people like that. But yeah, it sort of fell in my lap because obviously, as I say, I'm a Brighton fan. But I was heavily involved in that first shirt just because it had to be perfect.
Okay, Phil.
Really?
Yeah. No, that's not the diplomatic answer. That is how it went down.
Okay, well, when we signed over to Nike, it was a massive disappointment to me as a bit of a kit nerd. Well, because I didn't feel that Nike were going to offer us the bespoke nature that we got from Araya. And I still feel that's the case. Until this season's shirt, I've kind of been a little bit nonplussed by the sort of parts bin approach, as it seems to me. And I'd be delighted for you to explain why that isn't the case and put me in my place. And then I'd like to show you a couple of shirts made by Nike, and I wonder why Brighton couldn't have had something that was more bespoke.
I feel like I'm being lured into a trap.
Yeah, it's not a trap.
You are still welcome here, Sean.
I mean, you know, in all seriousness, you do have to be, you know, you have to work within the remits of what the brand wants. Mm. So, I mean, we've discussed earlier on in the week that there is a huge amount of politics that goes into designing a football shirt. I think a lot of people think, you know, you sit there as a designer and it's, you've got carte blanche to just go ahead and do whatever you want, so long as it's, you know, in Brighton's case, blue and white. Yeah.
But it's not really, like you look at your pen box and go, oh, Stabilo.
Exactly, yeah. But at the same time, you know, as a designer, you're part of a team that actually sets out what the brand needs to look like for the season. So as much as you want to try and put your heart and soul into a kit, often your first hurdle to get over is making sure that a shirt will actually correspond with what the brand represents for the season.
So when you're doing it, now, I mean, Phil, you know about this because you've got quite a lot of the ones that never actually made it, but presumably there's prototypes which are sent to the club and they choose which one they want.
Yes, yeah. So and the first kit, I've got to be honest, was a lot more special than the one that ended up being done. Because the other thing as well that you need to consider is what we call available fabric and yardage. Yeah. So essentially, you know, if Nike have a blue and white striped a fabric available, and it's a lot cheaper than, you know, one that they can actually, that they've got to make up, then obviously it's better to go with that. Because often it's determined, how much work is actually put into a kit is determined by how many shirts you're going to sell. So Barcelona, for example, would get a lot more, will warrant a lot more time in Nike's eyes than someone like Brighton.
No, that makes sense, Phil.
Yeah, it makes absolute sense. And I'm not going to argue that. And interesting what you said about the sample shirt being rejected. I've actually got a couple of old sample Brighton shirts from years gone by, and at least two of those I think are better than the one that we took on in the end, and all Araya ones, as it happens.
I was going to say, hopefully they're not Nike ones.
I've seen one. So going back to what you said then about, you know, available fabric and so on, I have brought a couple of shirts along that I wanted to show you, and I'd just be interested you're thinking about it. The first one is an English non-league team.
Okay, can you describe
called Hackney Wick FC. It's a completely bespoke fabric pattern. It's got a sublimated logo. No, it doesn't have a sublimated logo.
What's the sublimated logo?
It is a sublimate.
Yeah, what is one of them?
It's one that's printed directly onto the shirt. Right. So the base of this shirt, which I'm obviously people can't see this, but what I'm looking at here is, well, it's got a pattern throughout the shirt. So essentially that will be printed directly onto the shirt. And then the other applications like the swoosh and the wickers sponsor is then placed on the top. So it's like a transfer.
So, okay, so an English non-league team and not even a conference-level side, how do they get a bespoke, completely bespoke fabric shirt?
I couldn't answer that question yet.
Unfortunately,
I'm not involved with Hackney Wick FC.
Okay. All right, we can take it along then to a slightly higher level of team, as some people would say. Certainly Australians would. And this is a Western Sydney Wanderers home shirt. So
can
professional
you describe
team.
That again, mate?
So this is a black and red hooped shirt. Again, bespoke with sublimated logos, both on the sleeves and on the front. And actually mostly hoops on the back as well. Okay, there's a panel for the number.
Okay, so what's
Sean is now
question?
Testing the fabric.
Is your point here, Phil, that basically where you've got a Premier League, which is obviously the richest league in the world, not all the clubs can get a bespoke design?
Well, this is kind of what we've been told before, that we can't expect that because we are only Brighton Hove Albion. You alluded to it yourself when you're working at Nike. Everyone wants to work on the Barcelona shirt or a United shirt or something like that. I see two examples of Nike kits here, one from the other side of the world and one from here. So,
I would argue, the second one, the Sydney one, isn't actually a bespoke shirt. That is actually, it's a horizontal stripe, so it's pretty easy to reproduce that regardless of, what club it is.
Yeah.
But there are anomalies. It's not as cut and dry as saying, a club's big and sells X amount of shirts, so we're going to give them a bespoke kit, whereas another club isn't so big.
So, but when you're designing, we see the Nike templates and everything, and basically it's all variations of the same theme. So, how difficult is it to come up with anything innovative within the template that you're actually given?
Well, I think some people mix up innovation with sort of history and something being bespoke, because again at the start of a season when you set out the brand guidelines for what you want to do and represent as a brand for the season, you also want to try and bring in newness and innovation from an athlete's perspective as well. So you want to try and give them that extra 2 or 3% that's going to allow them to perform at their best. And obviously,
so this is in textile innovation and stuff as well.
So lighter, faster, stronger, all of those things are really, really important to a brand, which is all about innovation as far as Nike is concerned.
So it's a dry fit.
Yeah, but it's also about making sure that you tap into the club's DNA and actually resonate with the fans as well. So making sure that a club's fans, because they're just as important as the players, get what they need from a historical perspective. But also, you can gain inspiration from history, but at the same time, you want to move things forward from a design perspective as well. So tapping into what the club is looking at being going forward.
So with clubs changing their kit every year pretty much these days, how difficult is it to come up with something that is new? With blue and white stripes, it's quite difficult to do stuff, but I'm guessing when you look at what Chelsea have got this year with the Persian carpet design, as I call it, that's something different on a blue template. So it's go on, Phil.
Oh, I would just say on that side, I'd actually say that all of our Nike shirts have been completely different, so I haven't got an issue with that. I think the designers have actually done an admirable job of making sure that there's a significant difference every year to ensure that it goes on the shelf and the fans go and buy it.
Is your main beef then the fact that you don't feel that, I know unique is an absolute, but you actually want something that no other blue and white stripe club has ever had?
Well, I'd like that. One of the things, I think the early American Express Nike shirts where the panel was coming off after no time, I've actually got one of Bruno's shirts from that season. He only wore it for one game and the panel's coming off it. And you think, well, why didn't we have a gap in the middle of the print to put the logo on? The Sydney Wanderers shirt that we're looking at here not only has a gap in the middle for the logo, but it's not even a print, it's sublimated, whereas we had this big vinyl panel, and I know it's down to branding for American Express, but it did seem a bit...
That'll often be applied by the club. I don't know what Brighton's, what their deal with Nike was at the time, but often that can be as a result of the fact that, Nike will deliver the shirts in without a sponsor, and then it will be placed on afterwards.
Okay, so, obviously you've done Brighton shirts.
Yep.
Who else?
Where do I start?
What's your favourite?
I knew this was coming. The biggest, the highest profile, I suppose, was, you know, Barcelona, Brazil, Juventus. I was involved in the first France kit with the Marinière that they wore as an away kit. Yeah, I think I don't think there was a Nike team that I didn't do. The only one that I often feel actually got away was Manchester United, because they signed a deal with Adidas the last year that I was at Nike. I'd got that kit to do. That was that was mine. And then, as I say, at the 11th hour, they signed a deal with Adidas. And unfortunately, I didn't get to do that one, even though the kit was designed and good to go. My favourite was probably the South Korea kits that I did for the 2010 World Cup, which had like a tiger print all over.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously you're not there now. So what is it you're doing now?
I work, I'm the manager at Stanley Black & Decker now. yeah, so although that may seem like a big switch, essentially it's very similar, because there's a lot of innovation and stuff like that that goes into workwear.
Okay, so obviously going forward, we've got the Albion home to Everton today. We need to see a continuation of the performance. We're going to be completely guessing on the personnel and the formation, and probably throughout the game.
Oh, you try and pick a Graham Potter side. How many people have ever done that? So we're actually got fairly close to the end of the show.
We are. So I was just about to ask Phil. Phil, can you ask us that question once more to win a copy of the taxi?
Who did you have in the back of your taxi without telling us his name? Guess who I had in the back of my cab?
The Brighton goalie. This was a Brighton goalie who was at the club for 12 years, from 1981 to 1993, and appeared alongside Vinnie Jones in the film Mean Machine.
And if you think you know the answer, just send us an email to thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk. Give us your answer, and we'll be selecting by Friday the... Hang on, what's the date today? Friday the 1st of November. We'll be selecting two winners from all the correct answers.
Okay, and we'll let you know.
You're not going to get two copies. Two people will win one copy each.
Absolutely, and as we said earlier, it's well worth winning. So, but that is it. That's all we've got time for this week. So, of course, thank you to Alan Ware. Thank you to Phil Shelley. Thank you to Sean Pankhurst. Thank you to Gordon Drysdale. I've been Aidy Packham, and we're Brighton Over Albion. We're practically French.